You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Integrated Pharmacist Podcast. I am your host, Adam Balio. Americans spend over $30 billion on complementary and alternative medicine each year. As healthcare professionals, we need to know the facts. Let's find evidence-based medicine together. This podcast is not designed to be used for medical or legal advice. Thank you. All right, welcome to the Integrated Pharmacist Podcast. We have some guest speakers with us, and these are return speakers. We really enjoyed having them last time, Dr. Pam Tarlow and Dr. Swati Varanasi. Welcome back to the Integrated Pharmacist Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, just in case some of our listeners maybe didn't hear our previous episode, why don't you each just give a short introduction. We'll start with you, Dr. Tarlow.
Sure, thank you. I'd be happy to. I'm a pharmacist that practices mostly now in integrative medicine. I work at two places and do several things, mainly at an integrative pharmacy in Santa Monica, California, and quite involved in medication and natural products and integrative medicine strategies. I particularly like working directly with patients and with practitioners and educating students.
Fantastic. And how about you, Dr. Varanasi?
Sure, yeah. So I originally had the opportunity to meet Dr. Tarlow as a student, as an API student. And I did her rotation during my fourth year of API rotations. And during my rotation, I feel like I really found my fit. And so I asked her if she'd be willing to take me on for a full year and train me. So I started in July, and it's been going really well. We've been having a really good time, very busy, but it's been great.
Excellent. In fact, I saw some of your work posted on LinkedIn, and I think you're doing a fabulous job, both of you, in producing some very good content for integrative medicine.
Thank you.
So last time we talked about some cannabinoid therapy, and we're going to continue that discussion. Let's reintroduce the topic a little bit. Why don't you talk about what is trending in cannabinoid therapy?
I can talk a bit about what I get exposed to. And the main thing that I see of concern to me is that it is trending. Cannabinoid is trending. And due to regulation changes and so many companies selling it, the easy access, particularly in California, where we're located, that patients, practitioners, caregivers, they're asking about it. And they're asking about it like it's one thing when it may be many. It does come from one plant and varieties of one plant, but the complexity is immense. And this is one of the first botanicals that I've met where there's such widespread use and practitioners don't know very much about it, that our patients know a lot more about it in many cases, and the places where they get it know a lot more about it than we do. So, and it is definitely trending in medical realms and pharmacy realms. Some of the posts that you've talked about that we've done on LinkedIn have been involving cannabinoids, cannabis type derived medicines, and we get a huge response. Where do I learn? How do I figure this out? And it's quite a process.
Yes, in fact, I remember reading an article that you published. Why don't you talk a little bit about some of the things that you brought up in that, Dr. Varanasi?
Sure. So I think that I could talk about the drug interactions article that I wrote.
Yes, that's the one.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. So I would say, like, initially, something that maybe is not talked about in the media, and a reason why we think pharmacists' involvement in cannabinoid therapy is so important is the fact that there can be so many drug interactions. If you're just talking about CBD, it's primarily metabolized by CYP3A4, but it's also metabolized by 2C19 and also by a bunch of other ones too. But the two main ones for CBD are 3A4 and 2C19. And then for THC, it's CYP3A4 primarily, but then also 2C9. And so that's a lot of different medications. And we don't know like the extent to which they interact, but as of now, we do know that they do interact in ongoing research. It's happening and there's more and more interest, which is great. So hopefully we'll know more so then we can tell our patients and then they'll know more. But I guess that's like the mini overview. Is there anything like specific you want me to touch on?
Well, having gone through some of pharmacy school, some of those liver enzymes that you referred to, 3A4, 2C9, 2C19, there's some very significant drugs that we need to watch out for. What are some of those and what could potentially go wrong with those medications?
Oh, sure. I think a big one is warfarin, like when we're talking about those interactions. Other ones would be like antipsychotics, for example. And patients who are on that, if they are consuming cannabinoid products, there is a higher likelihood that it could exacerbate some of their symptoms. And so that's possible. There could be a big interaction with statins. And so a lot of counseling needs to go into that. Let me think. Oh, and then transplant medications overall, I think, are contraindicated. Would you agree with that, Dr. Charles? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm looking at our list. In our practice, we're getting so many questions about this that we've made a little cheat sheet just to look at, because saying those and then having that cheat sheet there is important. But yes, yeah, certainly. And these are not always interactions that happen, but we need to monitor for them.
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. That's amazing. That's interesting that you brought some of those drugs up, because it seems like a lot of those conditions that those drugs treat are potentially things that people would want to use CBD or THC to treat as well. So that's very interesting that we're going to potentially see some interactions, and it warrants some reservations when we recommend these products.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But whether we recommend them or not, that seems to be a practice by practice decision, and definitely a state by state decision about whether we're just in the role of recommending it or we're always in the role of keeping people safe if they're willing to tell us. I think that's probably, we mentioned that probably on our first talk, is for a pharmacist to be trained enough so that the patient feels comfortable telling us, with both nonverbal and verbal communication on our part, to really, really respect this plant, cannabis sativa, that it has potential pharmacological actions, and respect it from all points of view, meaning that it can be helpful and that there's a possibility it could be harmful, keep somebody safe that way. But first, they have to tell us.
Absolutely. I feel like that's the case with quite a few integrative products. We need to recognize that patients see the benefit of these medications because they are medications. I mean, we can use food and herbs as treatment options. As pharmacists, it is our responsibility to understand what those medications do so that we can help balance what they're doing and make sure that they, like you said, that they are safe and that they really are managing the conditions that they're trying to treat.
Mm-hmm.
So we found an article that I'd like to address. Can you give us some background information about the article?
Oh, you'd like me to?
Yeah, please. No, I'd like you to do that. If you could summarize it. And it turned out to be a really, really interesting article that led to the reading of several others. Who stops at just one article, right?
Right. It's hard.
Yeah.
Definitely, especially when they reference other ones or you're wondering. So the article was done in 2003, and so we had an extensive discussion of what else has been done since then. And so we had the opportunity to look into a few articles that that same team has worked on 2011 and 2018. So we can touch on those if you'd like to.
Yeah.
And you can cut that out if you want. Okay, so as for this article, I think overall, so it was looking at CBD and it was using specific imaging techniques and instruments to try to assess whether different brain regions were activated or not. Overall, they did see that there was, the patients reported a decrease in subjective anxiety, an increase in mental sedation, and they were talking about specifically the parahippocampal gyrus as well as the limbic and paralimbic systems. And I think it's also important to mention the amygdala, because the amygdala is also very important when it comes to anxiety modulation.
Yeah, so they picked anxiety. There are several different ways that you could go doing a study on CBD, on cannabidiol. And anxiety is the one that they picked, and they identified from previous research certain areas of the brain that had either more or less activity, depending if something was generated anxiety or it relieved anxiety. And there's some standard anxiety provoking incidents that they use, having a functional, or not a functional, any kind of spec MRI, any kind of imaging that automatically can put somebody in an anxious situation. And then later in the research, they used the giving a speech that as something that produced anxiety, an incident that produced anxiety. And the subjects in the later studies were given their topic right before they had to give their speech. So, you know, the heart gets going and the sweating and all that, but there are some established regions and they seem to be correlated with mechanisms of actions of anxiolytic medications too, which I find very interesting because they do. And it's not always increasing blood flow. In some cases, reducing anxiety meant there was less blood flow to certain areas that tend to be lit up when somebody has anxiety. And it's interesting to watch too how this progression of research has gone on, that they needed to start very simply with one dose of CBD, a higher dose than you would expect the average person to take. In this case, they used 400 milligrams of CBD, which is on the order about 10 times much as I see people who come into our pharmacy use, sometimes in that range. And they did get results. If you'd like to go over some of those results that they found.
Yeah, what did they find from that study?
So overall, it's similar to what I was talking about beforehand. So the decrease in subjective anxiety, the increase in mental sedation, they found that was statistically significant among their participants, as well as the activity of the parahippocampal gyrus. And so they're saying that is very much associated with anxiety and the activity of the amygdala. The one thing that we have not talked about yet is the population. And so I think that would be something to address. So I am talking about that the subjects of the study did see these results, but they had 10 participants in the study, and they were all male, and they were all relatively young. And so that could be seen as one of the limitations of the study. Another thing that we were talking about was the fact that they used the crossover methodology. We thought was really great because you are able to compare the participants and how they responded to the placebo as well as how they responded to the treatment. So we thought that was a big pro of the population when it comes to that information.
Now, that was especially important because some other line of research I'm doing is on the placebo effect, a scientific look at placebo effect. And of the conditions that have been studied the most, for placebo effect are pain, depression, and anxiety. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that this definitely was a crossover.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the placebo effect is one of my interests as well, and I'm glad that they were able to do that. Crossover trials are very intriguing in that way because we get to see within each patient what their response is to the placebo, and then are we getting added benefit if they're on the treatment arm? So mm-hmm. like I said, that's a strength of the trial, and one of the challenges that you brought up is that all of the participants were, shall we say, fairly uniform. It was a small group, and so it's going to be difficult to extract that to other people. But you said that this research led the team to run some new trials. Where did this trial lead them?
A few years later, they, instead of doing the same kind of experiment with one dose with healthy patients, they moved on to several different doses with patients diagnosed with anxiety disorders.
I was going to say, right, because the previous population, when they were looking at this study, the 2003 study, the patients were not on any medications at the time of the study, and they didn't have any other diagnoses, so they're considered like healthy participants. And so that's contrasted by some of the studies that they did later.
Yes, also in this main trial that we're talking about, the 2003, they had to say truthfully, hopefully, that they had not used cannabis products in the last year. Mm-hmm. So these days, when people are getting them in their shakes and their foods and all that, it may be hard to do research on CBD-free people. It may just mm-hmm. not exist so much anymore, which is making the research much harder.
Mm-hmm. I imagine so. And I know at least here in Nevada, there's still kind of a stigma, even though it's now statewide, it's legal, it is still federally illegal. And so there's still kind of a stigma. People are a little afraid to talk about what they take. Mm-hmm. as far as cannabinoids go. And so, even if they're answering a questionnaire about whether they've had some of these products before, they may be hesitant to tell the truth.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. And that all influences it.
Okay, mm-hmm. so this team, they saw a benefit in healthy patients. And so they went forward to look at patients who actually had anxiety disorder. What did they find through those trials?
They think they found that there was kind of they found significant results, and they found that there was a sweet spot. I don't have the exact milligrams to tell you now, but they looked much like we would expect in a trial where they did a small dose. They did placebo, small dose, medium dose, and large dose. And they found that the medium mm-hmm. dose worked the best to reduce anxiety. That was about 300 milligrams. The other ones I'm not sure on, but if your listeners would like, we can provide them links to both of those other studies that I was talking about.
Great. So it looks like what I like about that trial is, again, they had the placebo, but they also had varying degrees of intervention. Mm-hmm. And that kind of helps to strengthen that trial. What can you tell us about the population used in those trials, aside from the fact that they had the diagnosis?
Also, all men.
but it was more men, though. I think it was like 50-something men. So I think there are more men, some more participants, but still not heterogeneous, though.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting mm-hmm. finding. Why do you think they are targeting the male population?
Don't know. They're in South America. I still may, everybody that who I'm interested in, I try to get them in my network on LinkedIn and see that if I could follow them that way. So I may find out from them. But also I think we have to consider, and I would talk to them about this, that men and women handle anxiety differently. There are some physiological differences in some cases. And I would also offer, because of my situation and Dr. Varanasi's, that premenopausal and postmenopausal anxiety are sometimes different too. So it's just encouraging, though, that they are looking at brain involvement and are seeing a difference between placebo and an active ingredient like cannabidiol.
Yeah, I agree. And I wonder if it kind of plays back into that stigma around cannabinoids still, that I wonder if they were able to find male participants and just maybe female participants were not as willing to come forth for this kind of study. But interesting finding, and I'm glad that the research continues to develop. So it sounds like maybe 300, 400 milligrams of CBD is kind of a good target for some of our patients who are looking at mitigating some of their anxieties. How much does that amount of CBD cost? Say if a patient were to come in and look for a bottle of 300 milligram doses, what would that come to?
Dr. Varanasi, I'll let you answer that, and then I want to say a few things after that.
Yeah, sure. So kind of like how Dr. Tarlow mentioned, a lot of the patients that we're seeing are actually seeking doses that are like 10% or 20% of what they used in the study. But if we are looking at the study specifically, I started looking at, you know, some of the companies we either have in the store that we've been kind of conversing with about their product line. And so the range is anywhere from like $30 to like $75 or so per day is how much it would cost to get that like 400. There's a lot of questions about isolate versus broad spectrum versus full spectrum. So in terms of this, I only looked at isolate, but I wonder how the prices would differ if it was broad spectrum or full spectrum.
Yeah, that's right. Interesting. It sounds mm-hmm. to me like we're looking at in that therapeutic window that these studies kind of found was ideal, we're looking at a price range fairly similar to the cash price of a lot of medications for the same use. So that's interesting that we came to that figure. Now, Dr. Tarlow, you said you had some other information that you wanted to share?
Yes, so let's keep this in mind, and I think this is what we all have to train ourselves to do when talking about cannabis-derived medicines, is to really remember what they are trying to show in the studies. This was an acute dose. That's all they were doing. This had nothing to do with chronic. This was an acute incident. You're going for an imaging test. You're having to give a speech in front of an audience without knowing what the subject, not being able to prepare. Chronic use, they have said, that needs more studies, because we know that from recreational use, habitual users act differently than naive users. So keep this in mind. This is just research on acute doses. The other thing to keep in mind is that they were using regional cerebral blood flow as well as subjective, and then later on in their studies, some of the blood pressure, heart rate. But in order to say, I wouldn't say that our listeners should know it's 300 to 400 milligrams for anti-anxiety. It might be 300 to 400 milligrams for an acute situation, based on not having used anything like this before, where it also increases or decreases cerebral blood flow. And we may be able to get the actual outcome without changing the cerebral blood flow there. Those are all the kind of questions I have.
Very good questions. I like that when we look at this kind of research, that we're not just jumping to the conclusion, but trying to see, you know, what details can we actually look at? What conclusions can we actually make from these studies? And you bring up some very valid and interesting points. Along that line, one thing that kind of registered to me is, okay, so we've given these patients this high dose of CBD right before they're to give a presentation, but we're also, this medication is reducing their like blood flow to parts of their brain, which may inhibit their ability to actually give the presentation. So there are complications that maybe the trials haven't discussed as well.
Yeah, but I think what it's doing, from what their research showed me, it is calming the parts of the brain where you might get worried or have self-judgment. It doesn't really, it does not inhibit the prefrontal cortex, which is what you want to be firing wildly while you're doing a presentation, or freely rather.
Yeah, and another thing I wanted to add to that is one of the areas of the brain that they looked at was the hippocampus, and that area is known for memory. And so maybe it could actually help memory. And so I know that they're like currently looking at CBD for like dementia and Alzheimer's. I'm super excited about that. But yeah, that's something else that they kind of touched on a little bit in this article that reminded me of other ones.
Well, this is really fascinating. So it sounds like there's still quite a lot, even just down this one little field for CBD use, there's still a lot of research to do, but it looks like we have a lot of direction, and people are really diving deep into what this therapy can do. I think this is an exciting time. Like we said before, I'm interested to see where this is going to lead. Like you said before, cannabinoids have been used for millennia. This is an ancient therapy that has benefited humankind for thousands of years. And it's only just recently that we have inhibited our use of cannabinoids. So with that, I would like to thank both of you for joining me again and really diving deep into some of the literature on this very interesting and hot topic.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right.
It's really gratifying to have a discussion like this. Really gratifying that we're all talking about it, bringing our pharmacists' hearts and brains together to talk about what the research is and what the use is. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I want to thank you both for coming back and looking at that research and diving it in a little bit deeper with me on this. This is exactly the kind of stuff I that fires me up, and is why I have this podcast, and I'm interested in finding out what actually works and what doesn't, and what, you know, what clinical trials can actually do for us, and how we can use that in as practitioners to help patients live better in the way that they want. So thank you again so much for joining me. This has been a highly interesting episode of the Integrated Pharmacist Podcast. Again, my guests are Pam Tarlow and Swathi Varanasi. I will have more information in the show notes regarding the trials that we looked at today and some of their contact information. Thank you again for joining us, and we hope that you will join us again next week on the Integrated Pharmacist Podcast.
I hope you enjoyed the Integrated Pharmacist Podcast. If you like what you heard, please give us a good rating, subscribe, and tell your friends. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network. If you enjoy the leading podcast network dedicated to the business and profession of pharmacy, please write us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know which channel is your favorite. And remember, the pharmacist is the hub of healthcare.